For the week of July 16th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 374, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And inside the TARDIS, which actually is a lot bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, I'm Michael Giltz.
Now, the TARDIS, the problem with the TARDIS is that there actually is no location for it, necessarily. It kind of can travel around, right?
Well, it has, wherever it is where its location is. I was saying, your car has no location. You can move it, but it has a location, perhaps today, right out front of your house.
Is that like one of those Buckaroo Banzai things that, like, no matter
wherever
where you
go,
are,
there you are.
Wherever you go, there you are. Yeah, I knew it was something
That's
like
where
that.
You are. And you're not going to ask me why I'm in the TARDIS? I'm so excited to reveal this information.
Okay, well, Michael, why are you in the TARDIS?
Well, you know, I didn't get the theater job. I didn't get the other theater job. I didn't get the other theater job. But I did. No, actually, I didn't get it. I'm not the next doctor. The next doctor is Jodie Whittaker of Broadchurch. The doctor can go into any body, any single body, anywhere, can regenerate into anyone. And yet it's taken 50 plus years for her to become a woman. But thank goodness the doctor is now in the body of a woman. I don't know if that means the doctor is not cisgender or what that means. We'll have to figure that out later. But it's big news. They announced it at the end of Wimbledon with a little teaser trailer. She's a good star, a very good actress. It'll be fun to see her as the doctor. I hope that they've got a new showrunner, a new star. I think that will refresh it. Nobody could follow up Matt Smith and David Tennant. I don't think Peter Capaldi really pulled it off. They needed to refresh themselves, and they've done that well. My only sadness about it is that Alex Kingston, who was on the show quite a bit as a character called River Song, she was tremendously good, and she clearly should have been a doctor. It would be, if she hadn't been River Song, she would have just kicked it as the doctor. So it's kind of a shame, a little bittersweet, that she didn't get to be the first doctor. But having played that role, it would not have worked or made any sense. But she's proven you can be in that show and be a heroic character and keep it fun. And look forward to see what Jodie Whittaker does with the part.
Now, by doctor, you mean Doctor Who?
The Doctor. That's right. Everybody knows. Long-running British series. The whole world knows it's about The Doctor. And I should say that the TARDIS right today, this week, is located in St. Pete, Florida. I'm doing my world tour. The Michael Giltz world tour continues. I've been in Atlanta. We've had 2 weeks off because you were at a wedding. I've been in Atlanta, Orlando, Port St. Lucie, Boca Raton, back to Orlando. Now I'm in St. Pete, and I'll be headed back to Alabama tonight. You've only been one place, but it sounds pretty nice.
Yes, I was in Maine, but you know, whenever I hear Boca Raton, I always think not only of my grandmother, who spent the last years of her life there, and my grandfather, but I always think of that Seinfeld episode where George's parents are going to invest in a condo in Boca del Vista, in Boca Raton.
Well, if they had a lot of money, of course, they'd be able to take it easy and listen to all the podcasts they want, like S-Town and you name it. And if they listen to Showbiz Sandbox, what would they hear about this week?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're not going to Boca Raton. We're going to head right back to China. Some of the country's major entertainment companies are taking a hit on the stock market after criticism from government officials. Indeed, Wanda, the company we're referring to, has hit major snags in financing its debt and worldwide acquisitions. We'll explain it all, I hope. During our book filter segment, Michael will talk about The Epiphany Machine, a novel about a mysterious tool that gives users a permanent tattoo that reveals some hidden but elemental fact about them and then displays it on their arms for all the world to see. In case you're wondering, by the way, Michael's epiphany tattoo reads, "Likes to argue even more than he likes to be right."
Hey.
On Inside Baseball, we'll discuss the last-minute departure of two top actors from the hit CBS series Hawaii Five-0 and how that became a flashpoint in the salaries and casting of minority actors. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull info from Box Office Profit and Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world is Spider-Man Homecoming, another $117 million worldwide, $470 million and counting. So that movie is chugging along. And number two is War for the Planet of the Apes. That opened up this weekend. That grossed $102 million worldwide. It's in 62 territories, so it's a pretty broad opening. But it's not open in China because China has unofficially begun again its summer blackout.
Right, that's right. And this happens every year, so it's not like, oh, something new. No, every year around this time, usually around August, China will stop allowing imported films, let's face it, Hollywood films, from being distributed in their movie theaters, and that allows domestic content to kind of play without any competition whatsoever.
Right. They have blackouts around the Chinese New Year and blackouts in midsummer for like maybe 6 weeks or 4 weeks or 8 weeks. You know, it all varies. It's not official, so you can't really pin it down. People were hoping that because they're trying to prop up the box office and they got a lot of movie theaters to fill up with people, that might not happen this year. Certainly, Luc Besson is a little bummed that his film Valerian did not get a day and date opening in China, which he would have liked to have seen. And that movie has like a Chinese star in it. It has backing, financial backing from a Chinese company. I mean, they did everything they could to make sure they would get approval, and they will get released in China, but it will have to wait a few weeks. You know, they won't be during the prime summer box office season, which they have in China, just like they do all over the world. Well, but War for the Planet of the Apes is opening, and it's at $102 million.
And, of course, it came in first here in North America.
That's right. Yeah, there's been a nice trend at the box office. People scratching their heads. Why is this movie doing well? Why is that movie doing poorly? And there's a pretty awesome link between good reviews and box office. So that's nice to see. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy probably did not get great box office, but a lot of the big summer hits, Spider-Man, Apes, Wonder Woman, have been both well-reviewed, and the people like them, and they're doing well at the box office. So, hey, make a good movie.
Yeah, well, that's true. Jim Amos over at Celluloid Junkies has predicted that Valerian will open to $16 million. And this is a big film. You mentioned that. Yeah, I know. And that's only in North America, by the way. You know, you mentioned that, you know, China is not opening Valerian, but for Luc Besson and Europa Corp, this is an important movie because it's the most expensive European movie ever made. It opens this week in North America, and $16 million, it's not embarrassing, but it needs...
Oh, it is embarrassing when it's a $150 million movie. That is embarrassing.
Right. Well, they positioned it as a worldwide film. Still, $25, $30 million opening would have been much better.
Well, 50, 70 million would have been much better. When it costs 150 million to make, you're going to have to make $500 million to get your money back. It's a make or break movie practically for his company. It's double the budget of The Fifth Element, which is his other hugely big budget. He's had a lot of hit films that have been budgeted $30, $40, $20 million and made a huge multiples worldwide. So he's had a lot of success over the years, though he's not a very good filmmaker. This one is a big roll of the dice. It's based on a property that's really well known in Europe, the Valerian comic book series. It's a big influence on Star Wars. They know that name. We don't know that name here in the U.S. And the reviews have been dreadful, really, really bad reviews for Valerian. Similarly, this week coming out is Dunkirk. These movies couldn't be more different. Dunkirk is a historical drama set during World War II. Valerian is a sci-fi epic. They're both big budget blockbuster movies, but Dunkirk has great reviews. And Valerian has terrible reviews, and that's yet another example to Hollywood. Hey, make good movies.
Yeah.
And that's what they tried to do with the Despicable Me series. Despicable Me 3 is a popular series. Never great reviews, but friendly reviews. It made $90 million on the weekend. It's at $620 million worldwide. And number four, we have one of those movies in China making hay while Hollywood is blocked. It's Wukong. It's a Chinese fantasy adventure, and it's a prequel of sort to the Journey to the West movies and those Tales of the Monkey King. We talk about the Tales of the Monkey King all the time because there's so many movies in China and Asia spun off that mythological tale. You know, it's like Robin Hood to them. Everybody knows the Tales of the Monkey King. This is a prequel. It's stars heartthrob Eddie Peng, and he stars as Sun Wukong, who heads to the Immortal Mountain to gain the training and skill and heartbreak that all heroes need before they can go off on their big quest. It looks like a big budget. It grossed $37 million this weekend. It opened either a few days earlier or something, maybe Wednesday. It's at $52 million and counting. We don't actually know the budget for the movie, but it looks like a pretty substantial one, and that's a good start for the film. And number five is Cars 3, a movie that never got very good reviews, but it did sell a lot of toys. This weekend, it has grossed $23 million, and it's at $222 million worldwide, but it does have a lot of territories to go. And number six is Baby Driver, good reviews, and it's making money. $14 million on the weekend. It's just under $100 million worldwide. So it's tripled its budget, even though it's only in 19 territories. It hasn't opened up in China yet, though it did get a release date, and it's going to play in a lot of other territories. And I think it'll play well in Asia. So we'll have to see where it ends up. But even with just mostly North America, it's in the black already. Number seven is Wonder Woman, another $10 million, $765 million worldwide. this looks just like, what was that movie I was thinking of? Was it Guardians of the Galaxy? There was a movie, yeah, it was Guardians of the Galaxy, where it made a ton of money in North America and just about the same amount in the rest of the world, which set it up for the second film to really get a lot bigger, to jump up. This movie has been a big success, but a lot of it has come in North America, $380 million here alone, and another $380 million overseas. That just means the next movie, they've established the character, and that one's going to make another, you know, that's going to be close to a $1 billion movie when they get to the Wonder Woman 2.
There are all these reports now of, hey, you know, how Wonder Woman had staying power, how Wonder Woman had legs. I think only one headline mentioned legs, and I think they kind of regretted it, given that it's about a woman. And then every other headline had, you know, how it stuck around for a while, or it had staying power, or it went the distance.
Yeah, it's still in theaters. It's still pulling in some good money, even here in North America, where it's mostly played out because it's already grossed so much. But again, audience loved it. Critics liked it more than they should have, I think. But nonetheless, it's doing good, as opposed to Transformers, The Last Knight. They dumped Shia LaBeouf. It worked okay the last movie, but this one, not so much. $9 million on the weekend, $517 million worldwide. They're not going to lose their shirt, and it'd be great to know what kind of merchandising deal they're getting. Are they making any money off the merchandising? Because that's a long-established toy franchise, so they may not have gotten any money from that. But maybe that's goosing that area. Certainly at the box office, they're going to be okay. They need to gross about $700 million to not really lose their shirt, but they'll be all right. But not a great success story. Same for Pirates of the Caribbean. Dead men tell no tales, nor do they buy movie tickets. $8 million on the weekend, $750 million worldwide. So it should be a week we should celebrate, because they've tripled their budget.
Yeah,
$230 million. They've tripled their budget. So they're going to be okay. But again, certainly quite a bit less than they were hoping for.
Here's the way I look at this. Disney, much like Cars, okay, where yes, the movie kind of squeaks by, gets poor reviews, makes some money, not a lot, may break even theatrically. It will make money on home entertainment and home video and streaming and rentals. And the same is true of Pirates of the Caribbean. It's not squeaking by. It's actually making some money theatrically. But both of those films will help propel all of the merchandising, all of the theme park attractions that Disney needs them to. So in a way, they are using the theatrical releases as marketing for ancillary products that they do make money.
Well, you don't spend $230 million to push ancillary products. And the other problem is, if you make bad movies, suddenly people don't want to go on the ride anymore.
That's true.
Or it's not cool to wear, you know, you can't, it's better when the movie is pretty well reviewed and people love Johnny Depp. It's not so great when they're like, oh, another one.
Right.
That's certainly not the case for The Big Sick. We've been talking about this movie for a while, as it's going to well outpace The Beguiled, and that's certainly what's happening in North America. This is a film that was a Sundance hit, starring Kumail Nanjiani. I hope I'm saying his name right.
Kumail Nanjiani.
Thank you. $7.6 million on the weekend, $16 million worldwide. It's only in North America, and they expanded it wide this week. And it's working. It's made $16 million. It cost $12 million to make, so they need to get to about $36 million for us to say it's a clear box office hit. But it's chugging along, great reviews, good word of mouth, and I think they opened it too wide too soon.
Wait, what? Weren't you saying that they should have, or maybe it was me, I don't know, if you follow this line of my dialogue here, hey, good luck and congratulations. I thought you were saying that they should have opened it wide earlier, or was I saying
that?
My
God, no, I didn't. Maybe you said that, because that sounds like something you might have said foolishly. No, I think the impact of being in a crowded theater with great word of mouth, you know, they don't need to be on 2,600 screens for a movie like this. That's just stupid. It's better to have more people in every screening. You know, they're not going to run out of space. They can always bump up a few. But I think they went too wide too soon. There was no reason, you know, being 1,500 screens. Let every screening be a little more crowded so that you get that crowd reaction from a comedy. It's just a better experience for the audience. It's not the sort of movie they needed to go this wide on, and I think it's a mistake. They're squeezing out every penny as quickly as possible, and I think they would have been smarter to say, hey, let's just have, 1,500 screens. You can make all the money in the world on 1,500 screens. I think they just pushed too far, too fast. It's not hurting them right now, but I think it long-term would have been a smarter thing to do, especially when you're eyeing an end-of-the-year release. They're certainly going to bring it back to theaters, try to have an award campaign season, or maybe it'll already be on DVD and Blu-ray by then. I don't know. But, you know, they're doing well. They're making money. Good for them.
And I would say that having seen this film in a small theater with maybe 150 people, if that, it works when you have a big crowd or a crowded room because it is very laugh out loud funny. There are some moments in this movie that are just hilarious. And to hear everybody burst out laughing at the same time. And it's one of those, you know, whipsaw kind of you're laughing, you're crying. It's a really well made and well told film.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. I'm not looking forward to seeing Wish Upon, a horror flick, but it opened to $6.6 million in about nine territories. Got another new film here. It's from Japan. It's called Silver Soul or Gintama. It's a live action adaptation of the manga, which is one of the best selling mangas of all time. It's sort of a sci-fi period piece because it's a samurai tale, but it's set in the 18th century, roughly the 1700s, 1800s, the late Edo period. But there are aliens. This guy's the guy who created the series was told, hey, why don't you do a samurai series, a historical piece? And he said, sure, but I'm going to add in aliens. So it's a sci-fi historical comedy manga. And now it's a film. At $6.3 million on its opening weekend. But we don't know the budget. So it would be great to know that. So we're not sure what we're toying with here, but it's off to an okay start. Another new movie is Meow. It's a Hong Kong sci-fi comedy about a cat from the planet Meow who has come to conquer Earth. Unfortunately, the cat gets distracted by a shiny toy, loses the device that gives it all its powers, and he's reduced to being a fat cat adopted by a suburban family. Hilarity ensues. I'm sure it grossed $4.1 million on its opening weekend.
I kind of want to see this just to see like how crazy it is.
Well, it stars Louis Koo, who's a big star in China. And he hit the news a few years ago when people found out he'd been sort of quietly donating money all over China after a major earthquake and helping rebuild schools and clinics and water supply projects. And he hadn't gotten any attention for it, didn't want it. But somebody sort of posted on the internet, oh, this great actor helped build our school. And someone said, oh, hey, you know, he built our school. And suddenly the internet worked together and people suddenly put it all together. And when everybody sort of crowdsourced what he'd done, they realized how much money and how much work he'd been able to do and generate with all these goodwill projects. So good for Louis Koo. And here's another movie. I have no idea on this one. Da Hu Fa. I think it's a Bollywood film. I know it grossed $4.4 million since it opened on Wednesday, but what kind of movie it is, what's it about, what its budget is, I was not able to figure it out. If you know, call us, email us, let us know. Shouldn't they do that, Sperling?
Yes, they can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. In fact, that reminds me, we did not tease the fact that we will be discussing the Emmys later during this episode.
Oh, that's right. We forgot it in the show notes. That's right. Of course, we got the Emmy nominations to talk about. We're a little behind the times, though, because of our two-week break.
Yeah, and I know that because several of our listeners emailed us after the nominations were announced.
Very cool. We'll have one of theirs in our discussion about that. Getting back to the movies, I know what The House That Never Dies 2 is. It's a sequel to the Chinese 3D horror flick. This one is set in a sort of a famous haunted house in China. And this one flashes back 100 years to show how one of the curses happened. It's because a man in the military used witchcraft to try and get a son that he was desperate for. The first one was a big, big hit. That cost about $60 million to make and gross $65 million. I'm going to guess the sequel costs about the same. It's grossed $30 million so far since it opened about 2 weeks ago. Another movie dumping down is Fist and Faith. This is one of a bunch of movies from China about the Japanese invasion of Manchuria. They're all coming out on the anniversary and during summer. This one is about teachers and students who band together to try and preserve their culture and country's patriotism while the Japanese have their boots on the back of Manchuria. I'm guessing this one won't play in Tokyo.
Probably not. It seems like we have a single film like this every single week where we're like, oh, it's not going to play in China, or oh, it's not going to play in Japan.
Well, it's all about China and Japan at each other's throats. So yeah, that doesn't work so much. And finally, one more new movie. It's a German comedy. It's called Das Pubertier. Which I assume is the puberty or something like that. And it's a family comedy about a family, but especially the dad and his travails watching his teenage daughter come of age. You see him hiding under the bed while she's chatting with a boy. You see him freaking out when she wears nice clothes that he thinks are a little too racy. Every dad can identify. I guess it opened on a Wednesday. It's grossed about $2.2 million, so not a big hit yet, but there it is.
Now, Da Hufa is a Chinese film, by the way.
How did you find that? I Googled it. I IMDb'd it. I Wikipedia'd it. How did you find it? I saw you copying and pasting the title. I'm like, yeah, I already tried that. And here you are. What did you do with it?
It was in IMDb. It's a Chinese film. And Gary Leo wrote that it's about a warrior named Da Hufa who goes to save his prince from a dystopian village. He finds the dystopian village ruled by a fake god and his guards. In order to save the prince, Da Hufa has to defeat the god and his men and discloses the whole conspiracy. I have no idea what that is. I have no idea what that's all about. Right.
But well, that's somebody writing in a second language so often. So more credit to them for trying to find something and translate it and get it out there. So when you're looking up some of these international films, you do find the wordings a little, well, that's because they're writing in a second language a lot of times. So, you know, good for them. They write a lot better in English than I do in Cantonese.
Well, I do know we have some Chinese stories to talk about.
I that's right. But before we do that, is there a show next week?
Good question. I don't know yet. I'm waiting to hear on travel plans, but if there are travel plans, then probably not. If I have to leave town, probably not. If not, yes, there'll be a show.
Well, pay attention to our Twitter and Facebook accounts. If you're not following us, you already should be. Let me try that again. If you aren't following us, you should be. So we'll let you know there. Certainly, I'm looking forward to seeing Dunkirk and maybe even Valerian. But I'm going to go to South Korea. I may have a trip too. I'm going to go to South Korea to see Dunkirk. Why? Because the exhibitor CGV opened the world's largest IMAX screen in Seoul. It's 31 meters wide and 22 meters tall. I thought an IMAX screen, a real one, was a certain specification of size, but you can make it as big as you want.
Well, yes, within reason, because of course the projectors have to be there to actually, you know, throw the light onto a screen that size. So the larger the screen, the more light you need, the more projectors you need to reach all of the edges.
We're going to need a bigger bulb.
Correct. Or more projectors.
That's right. So talk to us about Chinese box office.
It's definitely up by 3%.
So, more notably, it's up thanks to international films because the Chinese hits have been few and far between this year. They're not having a great year, which is one more reason why we've had about 57 international movies released already in China in 2017. That's according to The Hollywood Reporter. I haven't found that many, but there they are. So, you know, that whole boycott of a limit of international films, that is done for good.
Well, it may not be done for good because, as you know, everything
they can
is done.
Change their mind.
Exactly. Since nothing is written down, it's always their rules. Which rules? The rules that aren't written down. Therefore, you're following the rules unless you're not following the rules that you can't follow because they're not written down. And as far as the 57 international film releases, well, that's because it's not only Hollywood films now, but it's films from other countries as well coming in, South Korea, France, Germany, etc.
Right, but the limit was on all international films,
correct.
Not just Hollywood.
That is correct.
And these movies are scoring big at the box office, like Indian films that are, you know, making huge money. So it's not like they're putting in a few art films and claiming, oh, we've got a lot more movies here. These are big commercial movies we're talking about. And nonetheless, the Chinese box office grew by 3%, which is sort of keeping pace with inflation barely. U.S. movies took 61% of the box office in the first half of the year. And that 3% growth may kind of be misleading as well. It may not even be that much of a growth because they are now including service fees in their box office admissions. So when they say the box office hit, say, $400 million, that now includes the fees you pay when you use a service like Fandango in China. So that online booking fee, even though the studios and the theater owners never get a cut of it, they're now using that to make the box office seem a little bit bigger. Is that fair?
No, it's not fair. In fact, it was discouraged here in the United States. And 80% of the tickets sold in China are sold via mobile. So really, you're talking about 80% of the tickets, 80% of your box office
service fee.
Yeah, is being maybe, I don't know what the percentage of the box office bump it gets, but there is a bump.
Mm-hmm. And so what about in North America? What percentage is mobile or online as opposed to at the theater where you don't pay a fee?
It is about 20%. We're trying to get to 25%.
Well, you're trying to get to 25%.
Well, mobile.
I'm trying to save money.
Mobile. Sorry. They're trying to get to 25%.
That doesn't include online if I go
to my... Actually, I think it does. I think it does. Yeah. That's one of those things where I always have to go back and look, like whether it's, you know, I have the reference where I have to go back and look, wait, was that just mobile or was it mobile and online? And I think whenever I look it up, I always think to myself, okay, this time I'm going to insert it into my brain and remember that it's X, it's mobile and online or just mobile. And I always forget.
All right. So we always think of China as speaking with one voice, but it's not true. There are different factions. There are the theater owners, there are the movie makers, there are the government officials who have a piece of each pie. So there's always conflicting opinions and conflicting goals that people want to reach. So in the last 2 weeks, we've had a fair amount of Chinese media companies surfacing in the news. First, the company 10% took a big stock.
That can't be 10%. It's got to be Tencent, correct?
Oh, is it Tencent? I beg
yes,
your pardon.
Yes, it's Tencent. Yeah.
All right. So it's the Chinese company Tencent took a tumble at the stock market because of media criticism. And media criticism, since it's a government-controlled industry, is typically coming from one or other faction in the government. So they were criticizing their business methods, how stable they were, and that took a hit for them. Then we found out that Wanda, one of the biggest companies in the world, was selling out of their theme park business for $9.3 billion. And people were spending a few days scratching their heads going, why are they doing this? What's happening? We've been talking about how theme parks are growing, and now they want to get out of it? I don't understand. And that was followed by a bit of an explanation, and that is that the Chinese government was blocking the financial industry in China from loaning money to Wanda for overseas acquisitions. Wanda's been on a tear, buying up theater chains and other stuff all over the world, and now the government is trying to retroactively say, hey, hold on a second. And you made six big deals recently. Four of them may already be closed, but we don't want anybody loaning you money to do any more of this. And we're going to question any more money to help support the deals you've already made. And now that has taken a big hit on Wanda. And what's going on there?
Well, a lot of people are trying to figure this out. But in the end, what Wanda has been doing is leveraging itself. And we talked about this a lot, actually, on the last episode. Here's the deal. What Wanda was doing was, if you look at Legendary Entertainment, it's classic arbitrage. They're going overseas. They're paying a little bit too much, $3.5 billion for Legendary Entertainment. Okay, that company, which made Batman and The Dark Knight, and you know, it didn't make any money last year. It lost $500 million. Okay, so it's a non-profit.
And Disney bought Lucasfilm for $4 billion.
There
the rights to all the Star Wars universe and other stuff for $4 billion. And you got Legendary for $3.5 billion. And that don't give you the right to make Batman.
Correct. And so what they're saying is, look, hey, we don't think that the asset you bought was worth $3.5 billion. You had a whole bunch of financial institutions in the country, in China, giving you money to take outside the country, to invest outside the country. It's an interesting way for them to get money outside of China. But then you bring these companies into China and you list them, since you're a Chinese company, you list them on the Chinese stock markets, whether in Hong Kong or Shanghai. You're listing them here. And when you list them, you're getting $4 billion. You list them for $4 billion. So you have a paper profit. So in a way, it's arbitrage, classic arbitrage, where you're buying something for one price, knowing that you can sell it at a higher price, at a different price. Sometimes it works the other way around, where you're buying higher and lower, you know, you're shorting something, but it's classic arbitrage. What the Chinese government is saying is, we figured this out. Please stop doing it. And oh, by the way, what's all this? You've been spending money a little too freely. You're like a teenager who just got their wallet for the first time. You've been buying Odeon and UCI in Europe for $1 billion. You've been buying AMC theaters in the United States for, I can't even remember how many billions of dollars that was, but then you went out and bought Carmike for another $1 billion. You bought Nordic Cinema Group. You bought Hoyts in Australia. You've been buying a lot. And where's the money coming from? How much are you paying? Are these accurate valuations? And by the way, before you can list new companies on our stock markets from now on, we're going to ask, are you making a profit? Are you basically asking people to invest in a company that has never made a profit? Because right now there seems to be, you know, it's like a free-for-all in the Chinese stock market. Everybody's buying. Everything is red hot. So, although not...
Well, growth is slowing down in China, actually.
Right, exactly.
You're making it sound like sober government analysts are just saying, let's be careful here and let's calm down for a second and study our financials and make sure we're on good, firm ground.
No, they're saying...
Or is this about a big company that's been growing worldwide and making a big name, and China loves the fact that Wanda is known around the world now by a lot of people, certainly in business? Is it just another faction of government that's a little jealous and wants to kick their legs out from under them and give their company a chance to get bigger?
Well, that's the thing in China. You never know, because it's always about who you know in high places, who you know within the Communist Party, who you know within government. And you know what? You may know somebody, but then your competitor might know somebody else. And then you have these warring factions, even within the government, trying to give their friends and family legs up.
But most of these deals that they're questioning are done already. Four of the big deals that they've questioned are done, including the buyout of AMC. Two deals are being finished, but they're really being purchased technically by AMC in North America, which means they are out of the reach of the Chinese government. However, the question is, even if those deals get done, if you need more money, like to pump up the film slate of Legendary, you need to borrow money. And the government's saying, all right, that deal that we put a check mark by, we're not happy with it. And you're not going to be able to borrow more money to do what you want with that deal. So now suddenly the ability of Legendary to make their film slate, now they've got a new CEO, a new boss, and they're ready to get to work. Now it's going to be harder for Wanda to get that going, which is why they sold their theme park business, which was in good shape, apparently. They needed to raise billions of dollars to sort of lower their debt level.
Right. So part of the, building all of these theme parks cost a bundle. And they are kind of selling them, although their names, by the way, Wanda will be kept on the name as the name of these theme parks.
Well, it's worth money, sure.
So they're basically jettisoning some of the debt, lowering their debt level and their debt to equity ratio. And they are getting some funds to pay off other debt. They're trying to be what they call asset light, okay, which is kind of funny for a company that went around purchasing everything. Ultimately what the Chinese government is also saying, is, hey, you wanted to roll up Legendary underneath the Wanda Film Group. So it was a kind of a backdoor listing. So you're taking a company that's never made money, at least not since you've owned it, and you're listing it. You're not listing it on the stock exchange. You're creating another entity called the Wanda Film Group, and you're listing that company on the stock market. And that company happens to own Legendary Entertainment. Well, no more of that. So now Wanda has to combine its cinema and film holdings in China and relist it. And so they've asked for their own stock to be halted for a while, on the Shenzhen Stock Exchange.
Right. So if you know a piece of the puzzle that we're not grasping here, let us know, because we're thousands of miles away and it's all a mystery to us. Reach out to us by email or phone or Twitter or whatever it might be, because I know people reached out to us about the Emmy nominations, didn't they? Even though we were off for 2 weeks, they said, hey, here's my thought about the Emmys, or what about this?
Right. Well, here's one from Joe Gaze, a longtime listener. He sent an email to dirt@showbizsandbox.com. He said, hey, kids, I would like to hear your thoughts on the TV movie Emmy nominations. So it's an Emmy nominations for television movie. It seems one of the movies is an outlier and the only one I have not seen. And it's Black Mirror. San Junipero is the outlier, and we'll get to that in a second. This is Joe from Delaware. And I could have sworn Joe lived somewhere else, like the Midwest previously. But I guess now, or always, he's in Delaware. So Joe, thank you for writing in.
That's right. In the modern era, when the Emmy nominations come out, you can say two or three things. You can always say some shows were nominated that shouldn't have been, and other shows weren't nominated but should have been. And the third thing is, why is this show a miniseries? It's a drama. Why is this a drama? It's a comedy. Why is this a comedy? It's a TV movie. So it's not easy, and I feel for them. But when you look at all the shows and what's a drama, what's a comedy, what was labeled a miniseries or limited series, as they call it now, everything seems to be in a pretty good category this year. Not easy, and we've made some modern assumptions, like Fargo, an ongoing series. We just decide it's a limited series because they make it a whole new show every season with a lot of a different cast. So we've come up to these new understandings of what we mean when we say miniseries and TV movie and all that. It all kind of makes sense this year, except for TV movie. As Joe points out, the five films nominated for the best TV movie of the year are The Wizard of Lies, starring Robert De Niro as Bernie Madoff, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, Great book, not a, probably a great movie, but that's from HBO, starring Oprah Winfrey, who didn't get a nomination. Sherlock, The Lying Detective, which is an ongoing series, but when they're not making a season of three or four TV movies, they just make one around the holiday time. So that does deserve to be a TV movie. It's sort of a one-off TV movie in that long-running series. Dolly Parton's Christmas of Many Colors, Circle of Love, another TV movie. And then finally, Black Mirror. Black Mirror is an anthology series like Twilight Zone. It's just had its third season. There were six episodes in that third season. They were all about 60 minutes long. One of those episodes was called San Junipero. They're all individual stories. They're just in, like Twilight Zone. There's a different story every week. And there were six of them this season. But for some reason, they took one of those episodes from that season of Black Mirror, which should probably be up for best drama, I would say, and they decided it was a TV movie, and it got a nomination. So it absolutely makes no sense. Joe's absolutely right. What the heck is that doing there? How did they submit all six episodes for TV movie? I mean, it just literally makes, I mean, you could say it's a limited run series. You could say it's a drama. The one thing you can't say is that an hour-long episode of Black Mirror from one of six is a TV movie.
I agree.
That makes no sense whatsoever.
I agree. And now you had a whole bunch of items you wanted to run down. We could go down the list of nominations, although it seems semi-pointless since you can just look that up.
Right. I mean, I would think in general we would just kind of get some analysis from it. But, you know, I think in general, you know, these days it's just, hey, here's a list of some shows you might want to watch, because nobody knows what the best drama is on television. Nobody's watched them all. Not the critics who get to spend their entire day watching TV. Not fans. Nobody. Nobody has any idea what the best drama or comedy is, because there's just too damn many of them. But now there's only six to think about. Better Call Saul, The Crown, The Handmaid's Tale, House of Cards, and Stranger Things, and This Is Us, and Westworld. Is that seven?
Yes.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That's seven dramas. So if you do want to feel like you can be a player at the Emmys and for your Emmy scorecard, you've probably watched some of these and made up your mind, like maybe House of Cards you stopped watching. Everybody watched Stranger Things. All the women I know watch This Is Us on NBC. So you've got a pretty good seven shows that you could say, hey, you know what? I want to have a sense of what the Emmys are like this year. Now you've got a smaller set to choose from, and you can sample these or watch them if you want and then be ready come Emmy time.
Well, and Westworld, how many nominations did it get? I think
22.
22. 22. So is that a record of some kind?
I don't believe it's the record, but it was the most this season. It and
Saturday Night Live
and This Is Us were definitely the big shows to get a lot of nominations in many categories. Hulu is a big breakthrough. You know, they finally got a nomination for a top award. They're up for The Handmaid's Tale. And Netflix, to me, looks like the big winner. They have three best dramas, The Crown, House of Cards, and Stranger Things. And they have two comedies, Master of None and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. So they are the big kahuna. They are it, man. For a few years, it was HBO. Right now, it is Netflix. They are dominating in all the big categories. And that's a streaming service, right? You know, a few years ago, we weren't sure if they should be nominated. Would the Emmy people resist? Well, they're making shows. They're spending money. They're hiring people. They're getting critical and commercial acclaim. And therefore, the Emmys are following suit.
Well, and it's interesting you should say that, because everybody, you know, certainly earlier this year in May, thanks to Cannes and their Netflix's inclusion in Cannes with two films being selected for the festival, everybody was saying, look, you know, they're not really a film company. They don't put their movies out in movie theaters, in cinemas. They do maybe one or two theaters in a country at the same time that you can stream them online. And they're not taking the movie portion of their business as seriously as they are the television portion. And I would say this, if you look at what they did this year for the Emmy nominations, and I can't tell you the number of times I ran across a building in Los Angeles, it was at least four times, where I said, oh, wait, why is there a Netflix sign on this building? And it was, you know, basically a building that had been rented for a short period of time, maybe 2, 3, 4 months for Netflix's Emmy campaigning. And they had FYC events, For Your Consideration events. And they would call those buildings the Netflix FYC Beverly Hills. And, you know, they'd hold these events there. They took on campaigning for Emmy nominations like it was a military operation. And guess what? It paid off in spades for them.
Well, they invested in that because they had the shows that had the buzz and the attention and the audience. And they felt like they could capitalize on it. It doesn't work if your show's not getting critical acclaim, at least at some stage in their career, like House of Cards, which has now been pretty much pilloried for the last year or two. But, you know, they're big names, big shows. And so, yeah, you can't have a big campaign usually with something that's crappy
right.
or something that nobody likes. So they're building on shows that were hits. The Stranger Things, everybody talked about. The Crown got a lot of attention. So, yeah, like the Weinsteins, they know how to run a campaign. But that's not going to work at the movies if they never release movies in the theaters. I think like HBO, if you want to be up for an Oscar, you're going to have to put it in the theaters.
No, I mean, here's the thing. Look, Netflix has always been a company that gave you content that you put on your television screen. Okay, that's pretty much what they're known for. They started making television shows, which, guess what, whether they come from NBC, Netflix, or HBO, is content that plays out on your television screen. So they really know what they're doing in that medium, you know, creating content for that medium. And it shows here with these Emmy nominations and good content, frankly, good shows.
Mm-hmm. And there's been a lot of stories about Netflix these last 2 weeks. They're the big winner at the Emmy Award nominations. They're doing great there. They've got new seasons of Orange is the New Black and House of Cards. And they've launched a new series, Glow, which I know some people had a lot of fun watching. They didn't think it was great, but they thought it was really fun. And they're looking forward to season two. That's the roller derby period drama.
Is it roller derby or is it women's wrestling?
Oh, is it women's wrestling? I thought it was roller derby.
I'm sure
you're right. It is women's wrestling. That's right. I beg your pardon. But they plan to spend about $6 billion on content in 2017. Does that, again, I'm still confused. Does that mean original content or for all the content that they acquire?
I don't know. That's a good question.
I can never figure that out.
Is it just mobile ticketing or is it mobile and online? It's the same thing. I always forget.
You got to look it up. Yeah. Yeah. They added 5.2 million subscribers in the most recent quarter, beating expectations. More people now subscribe to Netflix than cable. I assume that's traditional cable in the U.S. So that's, you know, it's $10 rather than $80 or $100. But still, that's a big marker for them. And they have more subscribers internationally than in the U.S. as well. They have 52 million subscribers in the world, and they have $51 million in the U.S. So they're at 103, 104 million subscribers worldwide.
So then pause for a second. It's 51 million in the U.S., 52 million worldwide for, you know, over 100 million, which worldwide beats North American cable subscriptions. So that's really what we're talking about.
Yes, they have more people subscribe to them worldwide than subscribe to cable. There's
correct.
About 90 million. Well, of course, because there's only like 110 million households, so you can't get many more in North America.
Right.
And there's only about 90 million who subscribe to traditional pay cable.
Correct.
And there's another thing. Talk to us about this funding thing or this content and how they're being valued. Morgan Stanley came out with an analysis. I don't quite understand it.
Well, and this is, CJ Flynn, one of our listeners, sent in a whole bunch of stories to dirt@showbizsandbox.com about Netflix. This just happens to be one of them, by the way. And this basically, Morgan Stanley is saying, look, the content assets that they have, these are the licenses they own over the next couple of years, and the content that they're creating as of March 2017, according to their study, is worth about $11 billion, okay? Which is, by the way, more than the content assets of Time Warner, which, by the way, has been in business for over 75 years, okay? Which is, you know, Time Warner is $10 billion and is larger than the combined content assets of Viacom, Discovery, AMC Networks, and Scripps Networks Interactive combined. So all
but
of those companies.
But they are including content from
exactly.
Time Warner and Viacom and other. That total of $11 billion includes content that they are renting, essentially, from other companies. Because 15% of that total is content that they own full global rights to. That's stuff they've created, like House of Cards
right.
and Stranger Things. That stuff is worth about $1.7 billion. So 85% of the content that these outside analysts are estimating as being worth $11 billion, well, that includes movies from these other companies. So it's stuff that they're renting and they don't own outright. So I'm not quite sure why they're mixing these apples and oranges, because they seem like very different things. There's the content you create and own completely, and then there's
okay, well,
expenses you have where you have to rent stuff from other companies and have access to it for a while to make your library look big.
Okay, correct. Now, keeping that in mind, let me take you to the next level here, which kind of plays off of that. Now, there's always this talk that we're always pointing to the analog dollars, you know, buying CDs and DVDs are getting turned into digital dimes with the streaming of music or movies. Well, here you go. Here you're going to have this, an example of this, because all of that content that Netflix either owns outright or rents,
which should not be combined,
pulls in about $1 of revenue per dollar of net content value. So basically, they can get, let's say, $11 billion in revenue based on the $11 billion of content they own today. Okay, today. Remember, you just pointed out, tomorrow they may not have $11 billion of content value. Okay, so.
But they'll have to spend less money to get it.
Correct. So, now, you know, yeah. Now, keeping that in mind, okay, traditional content value at Time Warner is $2 to $4. You know, the old way. So that
if they spend $1 billion, they can expect to generate $2 to $4 billion in revenue.
Correct. And right. So, or they, if they have, you know, $10 billion in content assets, they will earn $2 to $4 billion from those assets. So there's your analog dollars, Time Warner, to your digital dimes, Netflix. And that, by the way, Michael, is why Morgan Stanley is saying, you know, even though it looks like they're worth a lot of money or they have a lot of assets right now, keep in mind they're going to be earning less money from those assets. And oh, by the way, those assets kind of change from time to time. So they're a little
bit
overheated.
But actually, what they said was, I beg your pardon, what they said was there's a lot of untapped revenue in this $11 billion. We expect more growth because we think there's untapped potential that they can do. Maybe they won't get to the full $2 to $4 multiple that other people get, but they can do more. And that's absurd.
Well,
that's like you're saying your local TV station, and because you paid money to have Seinfeld and show it on your company and sell ads, that suddenly, hey, you guess what? The people who own Seinfeld, they make a lot more off it than the guy who has a TV company station and rents it.
Well,
and gets
well,
to
wait
put
a second.
You know, you can make a lot more money on this. That's absurd.
Their more, by the way, is not from hiking prices. Their more is get more subscribers. So if you're getting
it's not. They say that, look, we understand they can't sell. But that's the whole point. They're mixing apples and oranges. They've already got 104 million subscribers and they're growing. The fact is, when you own the content, you can sell advertising when it first airs. You can rent it to people like a network like CBS, and then you can syndicate it all over the world, and then you can sell it on DVD and Blu-ray, and you can rent it to Netflix, who will pay you $1 billion to have access to that stuff, and you'll have it in your library forever. So you can monetize it again and again and again. So comparing that to the fact that you've got a TV station you've paid to show reruns of Seinfeld is silly. That's not the same thing. It's like you're comparing apples and oranges. What you should be talking about is the $1.7 billion of content that they create and own.
Well, okay.
And what value are you getting from that?
And I'm sure what Morgan Stanley would say. I'm sure what Morgan Stanley would say is, hey, you know what? You're comparing long-term and short-term. And we're in the stock market. We're talking about a stock price going from 175 to 185 over a period of time. You're talking about, yes, a long-term play, which, by the way, guess what?
That's where you do good business as a stock person, when you're not trying to worry about this quarter, that quarter, but you make long-term investments like Warren Buffett and say, what is the long-term value of this asset in this business? And I want to not play the short game of, you know, rolling the dice, but I want to say, is Netflix doing a good, smart thing long-term or a bad thing long-term? If you keep looking quarter to quarter, you're going to screw yourself.
You know what I love, though, about this, all of these stories is that when Netflix reported that it added 5.2 million subscribers, right, over the 3-month period, which is usually slow, by the way. This is usually their slow period for adding subscribers. CEO Reed Hastings went out and he celebrated by himself by having a steak dinner at Denny's, to which I wonder.
That's because,
gee, I wonder if he was with Rodney Bingenheimer. Remember Rodney on the Rock? You know, he's retired now from being a DJ on K-Rock here in Los Angeles. And if you're wondering what we're talking about, see episode 369 from June 5th.
That is not my idea of celebrating.
Exactly.
I mean, I'd get a Grand Slam breakfast, obviously. Why would you get a steak at Denny's? Who the hell eats steak at Denny's? Even if you have some history where you're like, I go to Denny's for some bizarre reason, okay, but the Grand Slam breakfast, if you got to eat something there, I can't imagine eating anything else.
Well, now let me
ask you. But anyway, I think the fact for Netflix is they want to keep spending more and more money creating their own content because there's a lot more value to get out of it than just renting stuff from other people.
And let me ask you this. Because we kind of conflated the Emmys with Netflix, which, by the way, is kind of easy to do this year. You know,
HBO got more nominations, but Netflix has more players. So I think it's a valid thing to do.
Yeah. And, you know, last year, everybody was really happy that, like, shows finally, like, quality shows that were overlooked for years, like The Americans, were finally being nominated. But there's so much good TV out there that all of a sudden The Americans, hey, look, you know what? You won the prize. You were nominated last year, which is almost like winning these days, because now we've got to push you to the side and nominate a whole bunch of other shows like, you know, The Handmaid's Tale and The Crown and Stranger Things, because there's just too much good TV coming our way and we've already forgotten about you.
Well, the Emmys always makes mistakes, like everybody. And of course, the mistake a lot of them make is nominating the same show again and again. People really thought Modern Family would not get nominated for this year because it shouldn't have been for the last 4 or 5 years. Nonetheless, there it is. And in drama, as you can certainly say that, you know, House of Cards is tired and that should not be on there. I think everyone thinks Better Call Saul is just great. They think Handmaid's Tale is worthy. Stranger Things got tons of buzz. This Is Us on NBC keeps the networks in the drama game. It's the only show from a major network. And Westworld for me is the other head scratcher. You know, I don't know a single, you know, you're spinning out anecdotally from what you hear from your friends. But I know lots of people who like most of these other shows or are interested in them. I don't know anyone who watched Westworld who didn't say, I don't know about this.
So, I liked it. I liked it.
I mean,
so one person, you know, one person.
I meant a real person.
Yeah. I'm just a fake person, a voice.
You're just a computer program I create. Oh, never mind. Yeah. So, yeah, no, it's, I don't know a lot of people who are excited by Westworld or who made sense of it or who are eager to watch season two. Mind you, we've got a, you know, mask over everything. We have no idea what's going on with them ratings wise. They say average 12 million viewers. It's the biggest first season on any HBO series in history. Good for them. But did it trend up? Did it trend down? When did it start to level out? We have no idea. So, you know, they've got a show. They say it's a hit. It got a ton of Emmy nominations. And, you know, just as Game of Thrones comes towards the end, they've got another show that they hope is another long-term win for them. And, you know, they're happy.
Now, what do you think of Jimmy Fallon being ignored for best talk show? This is the
nobody's ignored. Nobody's ignored. There's nobody is ignored, right? That's it. You're not ignored.
Well, you know, I think that
there's 20, 30 talk shows. There's no guarantee just because you're on a show that you get a nomination.
Well, so, do you think it had anything to do? Anything. Do you think it had anything to do with? I mean, Jimmy Fallon had Donald Trump on before he was president, and he kind of, you know, kind of messed with him and joked with him, and a lot of people thought, "Wow, you know, do you know what he stands for? And do you know what people, you know?" And then you know his ratings dropped after that. Do you think it had anything to do with that?
I think it all had to do. I think it has as much to do with the fact that Samantha Bee deserves to be on there, that John Oliver on HBO, people think he's tearing it up, that James Corden is a viral hit, that Real Time with Bill Maher has been carrying the load of politics that Jon Stewart left years ago, that Stephen Colbert had a great resurgent comeback year, that everybody has a good story to tell except Jimmy Fallon. He doesn't have a good story in the ratings, and he doesn't have a good story creatively. He didn't have as good a season. So luckily, he didn't get on there just rotely. So, you know, you're bitching about it that House of Cards gets on every year. In this case, they said, hey, he didn't have a great year.
Well, you said that Jimmy Fallon didn't have a good story to tell. But I know every week you find authors that do have a good story to tell. In fact, you find hundreds, if not thousands of authors that have stories to tell. Not all of them are as good as others. And in fact, over on bookfilter.com, you pick out some of the best stories each week, some of the best books that we should be reading, because Bookfilter is a book lover's best friend. And every week you come to Showbiz Sandbox with one or two titles that you think Hollywood should be paying attention to. What have you got for us this week?
I've got like this one line thing for you to read to try and make this shorter because it takes you 10 minutes to get there. Ah, there are books in the world and books have stories and stories. I've written this one line for you to try to help you to get there quicker and you never read it. You take 10 minutes to get through and we're traveling over the mountains to the sea and now to the right of us is this. Dear God. Yes, it's time for Book Filter. It's books. Michael, what do you got? I got a lot of books, but I'll mention two. I mentioned The Epiphany Machine at the top of the show. It's sort of a literary fiction with a sort of a weird sci-fi culty angle. Not really. It's the story about a guy with a tattoo machine. And when you put your arm in it, it gives you a tattoo magically that reveals something about you or tells you something about yourself you already knew. And it's an interesting tale, but 60% of the way through the book, suddenly 9/11 reared its head and I really lost interest.
So wait a second.
It was set in the 90s.
It's kind of like the Sorting Hat from Harry Potter, but with tattoos.
Sort of. So I'm into it and I haven't finished it. Now I've lost my heart a little bit on it. So I'm not sure. So I'm going to go with Arrowood. You can't go wrong with a British mystery. And indeed, Amazon? Was it Amazon or Netflix? Who just made a big deal with the British? Made a big deal with the estate. I think it might be Netflix. Made a big deal with the estate of Agatha Christie to do a bunch of adaptations of Agatha Christie novels, not necessarily with Poirot and Miss Marple. She's got a lot of books. But they just made a deal to do a bunch of new mysteries. One is already feeling it's Amazon, and they're starting off with The Ordeal by Innocence. So British mysteries are always a great sell worldwide. Amazon recognizes that. And this book, Arrowood, could be fun for someone. It's set during the time of Sherlock Holmes. And while Holmes is dealing with, you know, posh clientele and royalty comes to him, Arrowood is on the dirtier, darker side of town, doing the dirtier, tougher, you know, lower class mysteries. So he sort of, I imagine him having a pint and sneering at Holmes as he gets all the headlines. But it's a fun concept, a fun book. I'm looking forward to finishing it. And you should check it out. And you always want a good British mystery, and Arrowood might be the one.
Well, for the sake of brevity, I'm going to say that wraps up our book filter segment and moves us along into Big Deal or Big Whoop. Big Deal or Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Do you see how boring that transition was?
It didn't have to be. Okay, keep going.
Our first story, there's no strike! That's the headline now that SAG-AFTRA and the producers in Hollywood have reached an agreement. That deal has now been signed off by the SAG-AFTRA board, though a contingent of stunt people protested the deal, and the vote by its members was only 70% in favor. We still don't know many of the details, though it's claimed the actors focused on big increases in streaming video residuals, improvements for background actors, and major changes in the rules governing travel for TV performers. More details should emerge as voting starts this week and ends on August 7th. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. You know, nobody wants a strike, but everybody wants their piece of the pie because it's a big pie.
Yeah, I was surprised that, you know, after the last negotiation, they came out going, woohoo, we got DVD residuals. And, you know, we upped DVD residuals. And I'm like, yeah, you know, nobody knows what a DVD is anymore, right? It's like, at least this time they focused on the right technology. Mm-hmm. HBO's Game of Thrones begins the march towards its series finale with a record-setting season premiere. Season 7 is the first one to begin airing in the summer when viewership is lower. It also began after the show's longest break from the air, even missing eligibility for an Emmy. Didn't matter. Winter is here on TV, and so are the viewers, with overnights and DVR accounting for a massive 16 million viewers so far. In a way, it means the show, with just 11 more episodes to go, is still growing. Last year, it averaged some 25 million viewers for every episode. And where this one ends up is anyone's guess. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. There aren't many shows that grow every single season. And that's what Game of Thrones has done. That's what happens when you have an episodic story and you're leading to a big finale. You know, the final episode of The Fugitive was huge. This show, the story has gotten bigger and more complex, and people have chimed in because they can watch it. They can binge watch it and catch up or watch it on DVD and Blu-ray. So they've been catching up and they're wanting to see the new episodes as they happen. I'm traveling around and last night I was somewhere, you know, Sunday, I should say. My friend was like, I can't wait to watch the new episode. I go, did you read the books? He's like, nah. Yeah. So this show is bigger than the books. That doesn't happen a lot, but it sure is. And it keeps growing. HBO definitely wants a new hit. They hope Westworld is it. And every time they get a big world-changing hit like this, whether it's The Sopranos or something else, the people say, ah, they'll never replace it. They're in trouble. And they somehow manage to pull it out of a hat. Maybe they've done it again.
Well, and then there's George R.R. Martin, who is saying, wait, what happened last night? Because I got to write that down.
Yeah, exactly.
Jay-Z's new album was made available to the world on June 30th. Not surprisingly, it was an exclusive available only to subscribers of Jay-Z's music streaming service, Tidal. However, it was surprising to many subscribers of Tidal that even they couldn't listen to the album on which Jay-Z apologized to Beyoncé for being a down and dirty dog. Why not? because in a deal with Sprint, you could only hear it if you subscribed to Tidal and you were a Sprint customer. So it was a double exclusive, or maybe exclusive, or how can I put this? What's the best word? A really dumb idea, actually. After 3 days of angry comments from Tidal customers, they relented and made it available to all Tidal subscribers. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I mean, exclusives are really the bane of everyone's existence. It just gives you more grief than anybody wants. Anything more than a week exclusivity really is a bad idea for the artist. That's what it feels like. And it's certainly not helping Tidal, right? They're not getting bigger and bigger or signing a lot of people. So it's a problem. And this album maybe, perhaps, went platinum purely via streaming numbers, meaning they haven't really sold any, but they've been doing a lot of streaming, and that album went platinum just from that alone. It's hard to know what's going on here.
444, okay, that's the name of the album, was released by Roc Nation, another one of Jay-Z's companies. And it sold 174,000 copies this past week. Now, it was finally released physically, so that's what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And so it sold, that's how many albums it sold as a full album, and then 122 million streams in the United States, according to Nielsen, who tracks those numbers. Now, those streams, by the way, are on Tidal, of course, Apple Music, Amazon, and most major digital outlets. However, not Spotify. So he's in a long-running battle with Spotify. But I did like Snoop Dogg's kind of whole rant that went viral about how he had to bootleg Jay-Z's new album because he couldn't find it anywhere because it was on Tidal. And he went on this whole rant about how he had to bootleg it.
So he's like, he couldn't buy it. He would have bought it if he could, but it wasn't available.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
For a week. So that's not a good idea. Yeah. And Spotify, speaking of them, they did sign a new licensing deal with Sony, which does include windowing, which means that, you know, artists can say for the first 2 weeks of an album's release, I don't want it to be on your free platform. If you pay for Spotify, the $10, okay, you can have access to the album. But if you're only listening to free with ads, I don't want to be there. So they allow that. They allow that windowing, 2 weeks of being only for paid customers. And I think that's fair. And so that means Spotify now has deals in place with both Universal, all the indies via Merlin, and now Sony. So they've got everyone but Warner Music. And then when they can nail down Warner Music, then they can do their initial public offering.
And I would not be surprised if there's a favored nations clause in that contract. So in other words, once Sony got windowing, all of them will get windowing.
Right. And if Warner Music gets a better deal, the other twos will get that deal as well.
Exactly. Now, charges of sexual harassment continue to bedevil the News Corp. Is it called News Corp? I think it's 21st Century Fox now, by the way.
All right. I keep getting that wrong.
Yeah. And it's bedeviling 21st Century Fox and all of its many subsidiaries. Jamie Horowitz at Fox Sports has left over sexual harassment charges he vigorously disputes, and anchor Charles Payne at Fox Business has been suspended while they investigate sexual harassment charges against him. So is all of this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, hey, at least Fox Kids isn't involved.
Thank goodness.
It's a company with tens of thousands of employees, and yet Fox very much wants to complete its deal for Sky in the UK, and none of this helps. It does show a bad corporate culture. There's no getting around that, and these stories keep dripping out. It's not good for them.
Well, and it looks really kind of, like you're putting on airs at this point just to show. It's like you're shooting your own soldiers to show,
What?
Well, it feels like...
You think they overreacted? Or I mean, the positive is that they're actually taking proactive steps here. The one guy is gone. The other guy is suspended.
Oh, I'm not saying they're overreacting. I guess so. Maybe that's a wrong analogy. But I guess I feel like, well, how come it took this, you know, the fact that you want to buy Sky to get you guys to behave properly? And what's going to happen once we agree to let you buy Sky? Okay, so are you going to just return to your old ways? Because right now, it seems like the only reason you're behaving is because your parents are home.
Yeah, all right.
Cirque du Soleil just got a little bluer. But don't feel bad for them. They acquired Blue Man Productions, the company that oversees the Blue Man Group franchise, a surprisingly durable brand that has sit-down shows in New York City and five other cities, including Berlin and Vegas. The guys behind Blue Man want to move into China, but dealing with overseas expansion is tricky, especially when you don't talk. Enter Cirque du Soleil, which has a lot of experience touring shows all over the world and also wants to do more business in China. So a match is made in heaven, as long as the children are a mixture of Canadian and blue. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I think, because it shows, you know, things are a little troubled, you're a little confused. Let's expand. Let's remember, Circ was purchased in 2015 by a Texas private equity firm. They own a controlling portion of the company. Is this an example of them trying to expand their way out of difficulties? They had an expensive Broadway flop. I don't really know how their touring shows or balance book is looking, though it looks like, as with Ringling Brothers, they've proven themselves for a couple decades now to be a really durable perennial in many parts of the world. But Blue Man Group, are they really... Does Blue Man Group need to expand all over the world? That just seems bizarre to me. But I guess it's, you know, it's live theater. Unless you go to that city, you can't see it. So you got to go to China unless you expect all of them to come to New York City. That ain't happening. So I guess Blue Man Group has room for expansion, though I wouldn't have thought so.
Well, but think about it this way. The owners of Blue Man Group, who have been doing it now for 25 some odd years, right?
Well, they've been overseeing it for 25 some odd years, yeah.
At some point, they want to cash out. Okay, this is their way of doing it.
I think they kind of have already, haven't they? They've made tens of millions of dollars.
Right.
But yeah, sure.
I mean, they own it. They're not just going to say, okay, you know what? We're really getting older up there in years. We're just going to retire. No, they want to, you know, say, all right, here's our payday and we're out.
Yeah, they've had a big payday, but you're right. They can't do it forever and they want to see the next thing. Yeah.
Movie and TV mogul Tyler Perry has been a major player in Oprah Winfrey's Own Network, OWN, supplying that channel's big hits like The Haves and Have-Nots and If Loving You Is Wrong. They've given the channel an actual presence, those shows, as opposed to reruns of Winfrey's talk show and her all-too-infrequent primetime specials. Before OWN, Perry was doing innovative work in syndication and with Warner Brothers for the cable channel TBS, signing deals to quickly and inexpensively produce 100-plus episodes of sitcoms if those sitcoms' initial run scored big enough in the ratings. Amidst all that, of course, he has films, including the Madea series. Now he signed a deal with Viacom, which needed to prove it was a player again after a lot of turmoil, thanks to a deal that means he'll produce content for BET and other channels, including at least 90 episodes of drama and comedy, not to mention hanging his shingle at Paramount, where they get first look at his movie ideas. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a bad week for Oprah. She didn't get an Emmy nomination for the HBO movie, and now she's lost the biggest producer of hits for her cable channel. So not a good week for her. For Tyler Perry, we can see, as an entrepreneur, he has consistently moved forward into new areas and new venues, from theater to film to television, hooking himself up with different players when he feels they're the best for his company's long-term growth. For whatever reason, he turned his back on Oprah and said, you know what? Now Viacom is where I want to be. So, you know, he's moving on and up.
Can anybody make money on digital music? SoundCloud is the latest company. Michael has the answer. SoundCloud is announcing they are tightening their belts, basically. Well, they're more like replacing their belts with a piece of old rope. SoundCloud is firing 40% of their staff and closing offices in London and San Francisco. SoundCloud found its niche as a streaming service that bands use for reaching the industry and reaching fans. Now they're trying to transition to subscription business. You know, kind of like Spotify, I guess. Revenue has doubled in the past 12 months, and rumors of the company being acquired by a bigger fish buzz around. Well, doubling revenue is nice, but not if you grossed $21 million in the last financial year, but ultimately lost 51 million euros. Most of the news around SoundCloud lately has revolved around infusions of debt they've raised to keep the company going. Big deal or big whoop?
That should have been 21 million euros. So they did increase their revenue because they're now charging for subscription, but they're just losing more and more money all the time, and they keep having to raise more debt level. So not good. It's a big deal. Not good for them. I know a lot of bands and artists who love SoundCloud, and it's ruining its culture and trying to do something it's probably not going to be able to pull off. It's a shame. It seems very, very hard to make this work.
You know, SoundCloud started as a way to upload audio files that you could then, you know, securely transfer to, say, a record label or to a music blogger. And it was, you know, secure. It was nice. It was like a little digital audio locker. And then it went public, and it's used for all these other sorts of things like podcasts. We're not on there. We probably should be. I like SoundCloud, but boy, they just have never seemed to get it right. I don't know why. Speaking of not getting it right, political gadfly Milo Yiannopoulos isn't done with Simon & Schuster. That publishing house unceremoniously dumped him when the controversial flamethrower proved too, well, controversial for them. They dumped a memoir of his right before it was to be published. Milo has now published the book himself and claims 100,000 hard copies have been sold, and he's going back to press. He's also suing the publisher because he says they rejected the manuscript as quote-unquote unfit for publication, even though only days earlier they'd emailed him about how excited they were. He's suing for $10 million. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I guess, in the scheme of things, even if he ends up winning. But it's not good for them. It's not fun. He claims to have sold 100,000 hard copies of his book, but we have no real way of knowing whether that's true. He does say they rejected him for being unfit for publication. And I can't imagine why they didn't use the morals clause. I mean, what happened was that they got an excuse to cut ties with him when video came out showing him speaking approvingly of pedophilia. And why they wouldn't have just said, yeah, we know you're controversial, but that ain't the same as pedophilia. So, you know, you would think that would work for the moral clause that surely is in his contract somewhere. So maybe he has a case. Maybe he doesn't. It's just a big headache for Simon and Schuster. And we'll see what happens.
Speaking of lawsuits, Quincy Jones says the estate of Michael Jackson owes him at least $30 million in unpaid royalties. His lawyers say Jones was receiving the appropriate payments right up to the death of the pop star. Ever since then, they contend Jones did not have his royalties adjusted upward, as was his right, along with the estate, was shorted on the money due him from the hit film This Is It, and has not received his due from the massive surge in sales of Michael Jackson's catalog. The trial is underway, and Jones should testify this week. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because it doesn't seem to have any sort of interesting legal implications. It's just the estate and Quincy Jones. It's not like a record label or bad accounting. It just seems like they owe him money, he says, and they haven't paid it. The one interesting detail was that in the Jones's lawyer's stuff, they claim that the film, This Is It, grossed $500 million worldwide. We know the box office was about $250 million. And we know in North America that Blu-ray and DVD sales of the movie were about $60 million. So that leaves $310 million. That leaves another $200 million not accounted for in this claim. It'd be fun and fascinating to know where that money came from. I'm sure it sold a lot of DVDs around the world because it was a collectible item that people wanted to keep as sort of a tribute to Michael. So where did all that money come from? Where did it all go? It'd be interesting to find out.
And if you're wondering, how does Quincy Jones have anything to do with Michael Jackson? Well, you know, maybe some of our younger listeners may not know. Quincy Jones produced many of Michael Jackson's albums, including Thriller.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of pop stars, pop star Josh Groban may not have won a Tony this year, but he proved a winner at the box office. The Broadway box office, that is. Groban exited the new musical The Great Comet, and ticket sales did an immediate plunge. Variety said, quote, how much of a sales driver was Josh Groban? Looks like he was worth about $500,000 a week, end quote. Grosses dropped from $1.3 million the week before to $800,000 without Groban. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. In fact, the news is pretty good. This is pretty bad reporting from Variety. They compared the final two or three weeks of Groban in the role to the entire run.
Yeah,
it's like, no,
work.
Yes. As he was leaving, the grosses hit a record high. It was actually $1.4 million. My apologies for that. And it did drop $500,000, but that's because it was at a record high. They'd had a few other really big weeks, but that's like the holidays and stuff. If you look at the whole run of the show with him in it, he proved a really good draw, but the show typically grossed $1 million to $1.2 million. Most of the time it was around $1 million, $1.1 million, sometimes $1.2. They had a couple big weeks where it went up more. But that's where the show's been at. Now, the second week after Groban is gone, the box office bumped up a little bit. It went from $890,000 to $940,000. So if they can gross $900,000 a week without Josh Groban and his paycheck, they'll be in great shape. That's going to be making money for them. So that's, you know, that's good news. Even with him out, they are close to what they were making most weeks. That's, you know, just $100,000 away from that $1 million mark. So the news here is actually good. And comparing the final week of a big star leaving a show when box office usually leaps up is not a good way to suss out how much they were worth long term.
Now, do you think that his, you know, without Groban, the show won't be as good?
No, I thought he was fine in the show, but no, I don't think that at all. I think the show's, if you want to see the show, it's perfectly worth seeing without him. He was definitely a draw, brought people to the show who wouldn't have gone to it. I have seen the show three times and I like it less each time. It's really fun once, as an experience. It's worthy, but it's not great in my mind. But yeah, there are other stars in it. It'll be perfectly fine. It's not going to suffer creatively, in that way.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And I guess this week, here's how this story will affect you. You won't be seeing certain people on a popular television show. Because just as the eighth season of CBS's long-running and very lucrative hit, Hawaii Five-0, was approaching, two stars were suddenly quitting. Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park were leaving the show over a salary dispute, while the two other leads, both white men, were staying. So Day Kim finally gave details on Facebook saying he and Park were asking for equal salaries to their co-stars Scott Kahn and Alex O'Loughlin. CBS's response wasn't enough for the actors, and apparently that doesn't even include the fact that both Kahn and O'Loughlin have a cut of the back end of Hawaii Five-0. CBS separately said they love Asian people and made large and significant salary increases, though admittedly not equaling their white co-stars. Kim ended his post saying he'd miss playing his well-rounded character, but, quote, "the path to equality is rarely easy," end quote.
Yeah, so CBS is annoyed because what they want to be seen as a salary dispute was turned by Kim and Park, in their mind, into an issue of diversity in casting and fair pay for people of color and women. And they're furious about this. They're very angry because, like, we have lots of people of color on the show. And, you know, they are supporting roles. And you can't pay the supporting characters the same as the lead. And we brought Daniel Day Kim to within $5,000 of what the guys were getting. It was almost the same. With a big salary increase, that's where we got him to. And Kim Park, Grace Park, I beg your pardon, she didn't want to work a full season. She wanted to edge out of the show, and she wanted to do like half of the episodes, like 9 or 11 out of the 20 or 22 that they're doing. And they were offering her a big salary jump and going to pay her the same, you know, per episode that the Daniel Day Kim was getting. So they're furious that this has turned into a black eye for them and questions about diversity and gender and pay equality. And they feel they've been really poorly cheated. And they're like, well, how do you say it? Mahalo.
Mahalo.
Mahalo. God almighty. Can I put an accent over the day? Give me an accent, somebody. Give me an amen. Yes. Mahalo. So they're saying mahalo and aloha to these actors and desperately trying to show how diverse and proud they are of all their show and cast. But it didn't work out. It gave them a black eye. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that certainly some of the things, you know, I wonder if the way business affairs at CBS runs, right? I mean, and by the way, all networks, you know, they're just following the book the way they've always done things. And, you know, we don't give raises that are more than, you know, I just right. wonder if like by doing that, you didn't see like, have you looked at the posters of your own show? Because there's four people on it. Okay, so let's start there. And yes, I get that like the first three or four seasons, maybe you banked it on Scott Kahn and O'Loughlin at first. So you gave them a little more. And you know, Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park had, you know, a smaller parts and they weren't required to be on set every day, whereas Scott Kahn and the other two were. I get that. But now you're selling this as a four, you know, basically four characters. And so you kind of have
to... Chi McBride is in the show as well, and that's one of their points they immediately brought up and other stuff. But yes, those are the four leads. It's not an ensemble like the Big Bang Theory quite, but there are certainly the four prominent players.
And it does seem like CBS wasn't about to publicly get into how they were negotiating and what their reasoning was, and maybe what they were trying to say is, look, there is a reason for everything in regards to this. Specifically, you know, Grace Park not wanting to do the whole season. So maybe, you know, writing her out, maybe we'll pay her a little less. But, you know, just in the end, even if they were correct based on legal status or the way they do business or even the way the industry runs, certainly doesn't make them look good.
Yeah, no, I disagree with you, though. You say, oh, they banked on Scott Kahn and Alex O'Loughlin. No, they didn't, because those guys were nobody.
I'm not saying they did that. I'm saying even if they were doing that.
Yeah, but they couldn't have because Daniel Day Kim was coming off Lost. Grace Park was coming off Battlestar Galactica. They were more well-known, certainly, than Alex O'Loughlin. He's nobody. He was nobody before the show. Neither of those guys had a hit. These two were coming off big hits. Daniel Day Kim was a worldwide sex symbol. Everybody loved Daniel Day Kim on Lost. Grace Park was on Battlestar Galactica. Tons of critical and commercial acclaim. They gave the show legitimacy in terms of diversity casting. They helped the show become a huge hit worldwide, certainly in Asian territories. It had to help that you had actual people of color on this show. It gave them proof against anybody complaining that they have a show set in Hawaii and it's all white people. So no, we've got them. What they did wrong was not having one of the two leads being a person of color. What they did wrong was keeping them supporting characters with crappier supporting storylines every week while Scott Kahn and Alex O'Loughlin got to do their bromance and be in the car and be funny. And poor Daniel Day-Kim and Grace Park were off, you know, fighting sex slavery or stuff like, you know, every week they had to do the serious, sober storyline and the two guys would breeze in or whatever. So I think they were bigger stars when the show began. They gave the show legitimacy in terms of casting, and they've never given them the same, you know, positive storylines or same airtime, which I'm sure they would have been happy to get. And here at the end, after seven seasons, they're going to their eighth season, and they said, well, we offered them big raises. That means for seven seasons, you were paying them a lot less than the guys. If you have to offer them a big raise after 7 years, that's telling us, yeah, you screwed them over for 7 years. Plus, they weren't even getting a piece of the back end. So I think it's a problem that for 7 years, they never thought to have a person of color be in the lead on a show set in Hawaii, and they never bothered to bring them up once the show was a hit. I think these two should have threatened to walk after season four. Well, yeah, that's when you're short of the syndication. That's when, not that that means as much anymore. They know the show's a big hit worldwide. They know it's stabilized. That's the time where you should have said, we're going to walk if you don't give us more money and equal us to the guys. And hey, how about giving us better storylines?
And that's, by the way, when salaries usually equalize after that third or fourth year.
Or equalize. Well, everybody gets more.
Right.
I don't know if they equalize. There's usually a lead. Here they're like, you know what? Yeah, it's nice that the two guys got a big hit, but this is our second big hit. So, you know, pay up. Oh, well, bad for everyone, but I think CBS paid a price, and I think they deserve to.
Well, and yeah, and we'll see whether the show suffers in the long run.
I doubt it won't. It's already, you know, 8 years in, so it'll be fine.
Well, that brings us to our obituaries for this week. And, you know, running into, you know, the show, we had the notes pretty much done. And then, well, I guess two people passed away almost simultaneously. George A. Romero, a filmmaker known for Night of the Living Dead, and he passed away from lung cancer at the age of 77.
That's right, and his manager said on Facebook that he was listening to the score of The Quiet Man while he was dying. He said it's his favorite movie of all time, and it's a great movie. The irony there is that in The Quiet Man, there's a man dying, and the music in the movie is so upbeat and fun that you can't, once you hear it, you'll never forget it. And this old man is being given the last rites, and then he finds out he can hear people screaming that there's going to be a fight. Finally, the American John Wayne is going to fight the local guy, and he leaps up out of the bed in excitement and runs off to see the fight because he can't bear to miss it. So, you know, someone was brought back from the brink of death just from the music of The Quiet Man. In this case, it didn't work, but, you know, he had a long career. He did other stuff, but he'll always be remembered for The Walking Dead. And a friend of mine said, hey.
Walking Dead, Night of the Living Dead.
The Night of the Living Dead. Yeah, exactly. The Walking Dead and all the zombie shows owe a huge debt to George Romero to the point where you can't even say the name right if you're an idiot like me. A friend of mine said, oh, George Romero died. I said, oh, really? I looked it up, and there next to him was Martin Landau was dead.
Yes. Now, Romero directed The Undead, and Martin Landau won an Oscar for playing The Undead, in fact, sort of. He won an Academy Award for playing Bela Lugosi, the Dracula. Bela Lugosi was Bela Lugosi was playing Dracula in Tim Burton's film Ed Wood.
No, he was playing Bela Lugosi. He was playing another character in Plan 9 from Outer Space at the end of his career. But yeah, he was known for Dracula,
right?
Of course.
Now Landau had a long career on Mission Impossible, a TV show, one of Michael's favorite war films, Pork Chop Hill, and Hitchcock's North by Northwest, and one of his best roles is a man who has his mistress killed in Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors. He is great in that movie.
Oh, he's terrific in that. That's arguably one of the best, if not practically the best, Woody Allen movie. Certainly one of my favorites. He was also in Space 1999, starring alongside his wife, and he famously turned down Spock in Star Trek. Playing a guy with no emotions? Who the hell would want to do that, he said. But I love this story from his obituary in The Hollywood Reporter. He worked as a cartoonist at the New York Daily News as a kid. And he was there 5 years, and at some point he turned down a promotion. He did not want to go up the ranks. He liked what he was doing. And then one day, out of the blue, you know, back when jobs weren't, you know, easy on the ground, he quit out of nowhere to pursue acting. He wasn't acting. He just said, I'm done. I'm going to be an actor. And he said, to this day, I can hear my mother say, you did what? And he'd been rescued from obscurity a couple times. Francis Ford Coppola cast him in Tucker, The Man in His Dreams. Tim Burton gave him that great late career role as Bela Lugosi. So, he had a fun, long career.
Now, you mentioned The Walking Dead, and unfortunately, we have a story about a stuntman on The Walking Dead, John Bernicker, who died while shooting The Walking Dead.
Yeah, no, it's very sad. He fell 20 feet, just missed the protective cushioning by inches. I don't think we have any idea yet if something went awry or it's just an accident or there's some lesson to be learned from why and how it happened. I know they will study to try to make sure that if there's anything new or different they can do to protect the people on the set, that they will do it. Hopefully that's what's going on right now. I'm sure it is. Production has now resumed 5 days after his death. I have a friend who works on the show. He's a still photographer on the show. He knew him. He just shot him a few days ago. So, it's very sad. The only positive here, if I can say it, is that this happens so rarely that we hear about it every single time. And it is a shock. You think, oh my God, no one should die making a movie. And it's true. They're doing dangerous stuff, but nobody should die delivering groceries. Nobody should die in any way from an accident. It's always tragic and sad. But at least we know that it doesn't happen a lot of time in Hollywood anymore because we have all these rules in place, and they're going to study it carefully. And hopefully, if there is something that they can do different down the road to avoid it, whatever happened, we don't even really quite know yet. I'm sure they'll do that. So it's tragic and awful, and it should not happen, and you hate that it does.
Well, what is also sad, but in a far less serious way, is that we have come to the end of our show for this week. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, or Microsoft Marketplace, even Stitcher. Anywhere podcasts are sold or given away for free, because we are a free podcast. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, and those links to ways to subscribe to us, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. And please do subscribe to us, rate and review us, because it does help us out when you do that. You can also find ways to contact us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. 888-567-SAND is our phone number. That's 888-567-7263. You can call and leave us a voicemail. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Every week, Michael Giltz has a new and exciting website for us to visit. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's, if I can't be the doctor, can I be the companion? .com.
And I guess that's relating back to Doctor Who. Now, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, you can head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can kind of go to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.